This is Barbara Glickstein, and you're tuned into Health Styles. The vast majority of domestic violence victims who show signs of traumatic brain injury never receive a formal diagnosis. That's a statement from Rachel Louise Snyder. Rachel is a writer and professor. She's the author of the books What We've Lost Is Nothing and Fugitive Denim. In the December 30th issue of The New Yorker, she published the article, No Visible Bruises, Domestic Violence and Traumatic Brain Injury. The lack of understanding on this issue persists in hospital emergency rooms, in clinics, in police stations throughout the country. And there's a critical need for more training, more felony strangulation statutes, and more research. One area of research you will hear about from my guest, Rachel Louise Snyder, is the relationship between identifying a victim who has been strangled during a domestic violence or sexual assault and its role in homicide prevention. Welcome to Health Cetera. Rachel?
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
That December issue of The New Yorker, where your article was published, No Visible Bruises, Domestic Violence and Traumatic Brain Injury, was really one of the first that I've read that so clearly outlined the issues as well as the clinical explanations for how strangulation is often misconstrued as choking. Can you explain or talk to that issue, even if it's not on a clinical level, but of course on a clinical level, and why this is such an important clinical distinction between the two?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you ask that because I didn't really know the difference myself until I started researching it. And so when victims use language to describe what happened to them, clinicians, I think, need to know and understand what the victims think they are talking about, right? So strangling or strangulation is when you cut off the blood flow, you cut off the blood circulation to the brain, right? And that's what causes loss of consciousness. You can still breathe while you're being strangled, which is something I didn't know. Choking is when the airway is actually cut off. So often you'll have a situation where a victim has had both things happen to her. Maybe she's had, you know, a pair of socks shoved in her mouth and she's being strangled. There's two different things. But when victims go into an ER, if they go in, of course, many, many don't, they often say, he was choking me. Because in the language, it sounds softer somehow than I was being strangled, right? Strangulation or being strangled has this this ominous kind of psychology to it that I think is difficult when you're talking about somebody who claims to love you. So understanding the difference is something that victims don't often have. So anyway, I had to learn that myself, and I was surprised by the use of choking sort of universally as the way that people describe what's happened to them.
And I'm wondering also that the word strangled versus choking, for the general public, I'm making a very big generalization here, one thinks about being strangled as resulting in death and not being still alive to talk about it. Would you say that's kind of true, or am I misleading that explanation?
You can have non-fatal strangulation, yeah. And in fact, it's been the non-fatal strangulations that have led to our current knowledge of how dangerous strangulation is. I feel sort of like I'm talking in circles. If somebody is strangled to death, which can, by the way, happen very quickly, and of course it does happen a lot, we don't look for traumatic brain injury, right? We wouldn't screen for that because we know how that person died. So these things are interconnected. I mean, you can be injured by any of them individually, either a fatal injury or a non-fatal injury, but they also have a cumulative effect on victims.
Because of the lack of oxygen to the brain and subtle brain injuries?
Yeah, because of the lack of oxygen to the brain, but also because in a domestic violence situation, usually somebody isn't strangled just one time non-fatally. Usually they have years and years of these incidences, and any kind of brain injury, any doctor will tell you is has a cumulative effect. So, you know, and the other thing is that strangulation is often accompanied by, you know, blunt force trauma to the head, which causes traumatic brain injury. We see that in football players. We see that in car accident victims. Hopefully we will start to see that in domestic violence situations as well.
Yes, and I know that the current and growing research in traumatic brain injury from those other fields, certainly football, and with the release this past year in 2015 of the movie Concussion, some of the pushback in the sports world around not wanting to raise that red flag that these injuries and concussions over periods of time create pretty serious brain damage. So before In your article that you published in the December 30th issue of The New Yorker, No Visible Bruises, Domestic Violence, and Traumatic Brain Injury, my guest is Rachel Louise Snyder, you talk about how strangulation was often both misconstrued, but in addition, the strangulation crimes were in many states still classified as misdemeanor assaults, and the research around prevention of homicide. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Sure. Currently, there are 38 states that have strangulation felony laws. So that means there are at least a dozen in which strangulation is still a misdemeanor. And what the research says now and what we now know is that strangulation is the penultimate or the final act before homicide. The violence doesn't reduce from strangulation. It only increases. And so it's a very, very dangerous marker for people to be aware of. It's also very hard to detect. People, first responders, for example, are not trained in looking for the signs of strangulation that are not visible. They might look, for example, for a bruise on the neck or bruising on the neck, but in the study that I saw, only about 15% of victims had bruises that were visible enough to photograph. So you just don't see that. There was a story I came across of a woman who had a carotid artery dissection because of strangulation and didn't know it. She was up walking, talking around. Now, she did have bruising around her ear and was immediately sent to the ER, where they put her in a safe ward, you know, under a pseudonym. But these injuries are happening and people don't know it. Women might have raspy voices. They might have urinated or defecated on themselves and be embarrassed by that, as any of us would be, not knowing that that's a sign that you're minutes or seconds away from death. Many women don't know that they've lost consciousness in a strangulation struggle. It's a hysterical moment normally, right? They're screaming, they're trying to get his hands away from their neck, and they don't know. And the cops will come and they'll say, you know, I don't know, I was in this part of the room and in that part of the room, and they have terrible memories, which means they're disbelieved and they can't advocate for themselves, and so they're never diagnosed. It is a shocking and troubling set of ripple effects that happen because we fail these victims.
And in some instances, if law enforcement's not called, either by someone who's also in the home observing the violence, or the woman manages to escape into a locked bathroom door and has her mobile phone with her, there are some women get themselves to the emergency room. And again, it could be a period of time after the incident. It may not be immediately after the incident, but they're able to walk themselves in, perhaps, and not aware that, as you mentioned, this one woman who had bruising behind her ear, which was a symptom of a potentially deadly result of a carotid artery rupture, which would have been immediately, spontaneously fatal. So we have mm-hmm. we have many scenarios, you know, people mm-hmm. Who are listening understand it, who have heard reporting before on domestic violence victims. And, of course, the majority of victims are women and the perpetrators are men, so we're using the appropriate gender here, although we're, mm-hmm. I know, Rachel, you have extensive background on reporting on this issue, that there are a percentage of certainly in the LGBT community domestic relationships where men are also victims of this terrible crime.
Yeah, mm-hmm, absolutely.
So in some states have actually moved forward, and so we have the law enforcement path moving forward. I believe that you said there were 37 or 39 states now who have passed felony strangulation laws.
38.
Okay, it's in the middle. And the strangulation language has now been added to the federal law, I believe, for the first time. What have you learned about the training and education of first responders, and where does that path of conscious education and awareness, how is that working as a result of the change of some of these laws in the states that have changed the law to make it a felony?
Well, it's too recent for any researchers to actually have a causal effect yet, because that was just 2014 that the Supreme Court wrote strangulation and suffocation into their sentencing laws, suggesting increased, not suggesting, making it imperative for increased jail time for people found guilty of those kinds of felonies. But there is a county, Maricopa County in Arizona, that has done quite extensive research. They actually did a pilot project where they trained all their first responders on strangulation, and they used pedagogy that has been created by the Strangulation Training Institute out of San Diego. And so they've trained not only their first responders, law enforcement, but 9/11 operators, emergency room personnel, prosecutors, district attorneys, anybody who deals with it, advocates, shelter workers, and they also put a forensic nurse on staff to work with these people. So they their prosecution rate went way, way up. It was something like 14%, and it went up to, I think it's around 70% now, prosecutions for strangulation cases. And their homicide rate has gone down. Now, I talked to their city district, a county district attorney, and he said, I can't go on record and say, this is a result of that, certainly. But it does seem to point in that direction, and we've got funding right now to really establish that causal effect. But it does stand to reason that when you put abusers who are this dangerous, who strangle their partners to the loss of consciousness or to have traumatic brain injuries, you put them in prison, it will affect homicide rates. It will make homicide rates go down. So, the hope is that more and more people will get the word out, more and more people will understand the signs and symptoms and what to look for, because those first 24 to 48 hours are the most dangerous for victims. Certainly they can have a stroke, they can have, they can choke on their own vomit, but they can have a stroke even years later. So, those danger signs don't necessarily go away with time. And traumatic brain injury, we know, takes years and years to heal, if ever.
In your article, you, in addition to the evidence and the research and the people who have researched in this field, and you've mentioned some of them, you provide stories, of course, stories that are not identifying the names of the victims directly. And in one of the instances, a woman's children was taken away from her. Can you talk about that case?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. These are the stakes involved that these women don't, or that people in general just don't understand. There was a woman who had such severe injuries. She had lost the ability to read and write. And the court said, you can't raise your children unless you can read, right? You can't read a recipe. You can't read their school letters and things like that. And so they were taken and put in foster care, and she is slowly learning to read again. She, when I last heard, she was able to read the newspaper, which was a real win for her, because she is, in fact, getting better, and she's back now. But there's another woman that I came across, too, in my research, who had such severe brain injury that she had to move back in with her parents and now has to be escorted wherever she goes. You know, she gets to the front door and can't remember where she was going. And, these women, 99% of the strangulation victims we know are women. And, they go to court and they try to file restraining orders and they lose their restraining orders, or the court doesn't believe them because they can't remember what happened, or they have to have joint custody with a man who is terribly, terribly abusive because they have no diagnosis from the court. It is, first of all, a terrifying situation, but second of all, a situation that we actually have the tools to change now, today.
One of the experiences that I had early on during my senior year of nursing school was I interviewed a nurse who had a tremendous impact on domestic violence legislation and clinical guidelines in New York State, and I'll briefly tell you the story. She herself had been living in a domestic violence relationship for a number of years. If I remember correctly, it was 6 or 7 years. And as an ER nurse, knew that she couldn't go anywhere near the hospitals where her colleagues might recognize her. And so when she was badly injured from her abuser, her husband at the time, she would travel long distances to go to emergency rooms, and in those emergency rooms also create a false statement about how she got the black eye, broke her shoulder, et cetera, terrible, terrible injuries. And it took her time and support by those around her to finally leave this situation. And when she was strong enough and recovered from a period of time of support and therapy and healing, she became an activist in this field and would speak eloquently and very personally about how hidden this is in her own experience, mm-hmm. and that women would come in and she would look in their eyes and know it was the same as her, that she didn't believe mm-hmm. those stories. And I know that it's spoken to about, but please speak to the difficulty of and how hard it is for women to come out of these abusive situations.
Yeah, I mean, this is something else I'd like to write about, because this is one of the most common things you hear. Why doesn't she just leave? Why doesn't she just leave? And, when a football player is on television and he is, pounded and he has help off the field by the doctor and by his coaches, that is a visual support system, right? Not to mention the many, many thousands of us who have seen that on TV who are, advocating for him, who are saying, oh, gosh, it's so terrible. Domestic violence victims have none of that support system. They are often ashamed, because most of the survivors that I talk to, and this is, I think, particularly true of male survivors of domestic violence, feel a sort of responsibility for making a bad choice. If I wouldn't have made the bad choice, I wouldn't have been in that situation, right? So there's a lot of self-blame that goes on. There's a lot of economic dependence. And, of course, an abuser ultimately has proven that he has power over that victim, right? So it's not a matter of just physical power. It is years and years of saying, you're nothing, I own you, you're nothing without me, right? And it's very, very difficult to leave. It's also very dangerous to leave. Many, many women have been killed at that moment of trying to leave. Researchers now know that that is, in fact, the most dangerous time for any victim, is when they're trying to leave. So there's a whole constellation of factors and pressures that go into keeping a victim from being able to leave that situation, in addition to our systems of law enforcement and healthcare, which just don't know. The woman that you spoke of, we need more women like her, not former not former victims, but women who can look in the eyes of a victim and say, I know your story, right? Women who can, or healthcare workers who can look and say, we need to do a CT scan on this woman, or, you know, I smell urine around this woman. I think that maybe she's urinated on herself. I need to ask that question, right? It's just a matter of training. It's a simple matter of training. But we have the tools right now to help people in this situation. We just have to get the knowledge out there.
You know, you mentioned forensics and forensic nursing, a field that is so critically important in all potential cases of crime. When a forensic nurse is called in for a case in the emergency room, what he or she knows and learns about this field and other fields of violence, and the evidence that is looked for as whether it's the visible mark on the person's neck, behind their ear, that some of the symptoms you've also just mentioned in terms of the smell of urination, and the question of, do you remember if you passed out, and someone saying, no, I can't remember, that may be a clue for further investigation, an MRI or a CAT scan of the brain. And, you know, I have colleagues who are forensic nurses, and I'm constantly educated both on their stance. They're not there for the police, they're there for the patient. I have had, I've been corrected in the cases of if a person doesn't want to prosecute, that is not the role of the forensic nurse to convince them otherwise. That is not their role. Mm-hmm. And so I'm saying that for those who are listening who may find themselves in a situation where a forensic nurse is coming in to be with you during an examination of this nature, that you have private time with them, but they're trained very exquisitely and very confidently will protect you from what it is that you're capable of doing at that time. Calling in a forensic nurse does not mean that you are then turned, that person's turned over to the police, as much as my argument was, why not? And the forensic nurse expert that I interviewed about something recent around human trafficking, she said, it's not my decision for a woman to step forth and want to go through with any kind of a prosecution against her perpetrator. Kind of nuanced, of course, but again, time and readiness and support, knowing that he or she can go back to a safe environment, is not always clear, and we don't always know why someone is making a particular decision at that time.
Well, and what a lot of states have done, and the woman I interviewed, Gail Strack from the Strangulation Institute, talked about this, is figuring out how to prosecute a case without the victim's testimony. Because, of course, victims do recant, and they recant for all the same reasons that they stay in these relationships, because they're scared, because they have to, because they love that person, because that person is the co-parent with them. I mean, there's all kinds of complicated reasons why people make the decisions that they make. But as she pointed out to me, we prosecute homicides all the time without the victim's testimony.
Yes, we do. And for many women, they know that being on the stand, being questioned by the defense attorney is humiliating, can be humiliating, I should say, and also traumatizing. You know, it's one of those times where what we see on television and the supportive crew around one of the sex violence TV programs may not always be who's there for the victim. Often it is, and I think they're highly trained people in this field in the criminal justice system. But it may not be enough for someone, and so we don't want to recreate a victim who's not quite ready to step forth. You mentioned earlier in the interview about data and the need for more data that would drive more of the persecution, both prosecuting the perpetrator. But what other kinds of research do you understand now from this investigative piece that you did that needs better reporting?
Oh, that's a tough question. You know, I think that I'm unprepared for that answer.
Okay. Well, I know that brain is, well, that's very honest. I love that about you. Rachel Louise Snyder, the area of brain trauma perhaps is, you know, some of this, these injuries and reporting of these injuries and symptomology following these cases, you know, it's an entirely new field in neuroscience and neurotrauma that we mm-hmm. don't really, I think, don't really have all the information, and every time something new is identified about injury to a certain part of the brain and its impact on the person's life, is a growing field. So I'll answer that one.
Absolutely.
I'll answer that one for you. So we just have a minute left. You've mentioned that you want to, what next you may be writing about. Do you want to give us a little cue on that? I know you're...
Yeah, I'm all domestic violence all the time. I just finished a piece for Marie Claire on guns and domestic violence. I'm writing about a domestic violence, a Supreme Court case next month for The New Yorker again. And then I'd like to write about why victims stay. I interviewed a woman not long ago whose abuser is imprisoned for life for torture. And after he went to prison, she married him. And it belies logic to most people, and I said to her, I want to talk to you more. So I'm gonna be talking to her a bit more as well, and just try to understand that mindset, because I think the more knowledge we have about the dark places in our world, the
yes.
more we can sort of shed light on them, the
yes.
more we can make change. So
yeah. Isn't that what a good reporter does? And I think you've certainly shown us from your writing, both your books, What We've Lost Is Nothing and Fugitive Denim, and certainly this December 3rd issue of The New Yorker, the article that you published, No Visible Bruises, Domestic Violence and Traumatic Brain Injury. That article is available online for our listeners. You need not be a subscriber to the magazine, and I urge you to read the entire piece. I want to thank you for joining me today on Health Cetera. Rachel Louise Snyder is a writer and a professor, and you have covered so much territory on this area. You have shed light on an area of darkness, and I appreciate your joining me today on Health Cetera.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.